So, let us begin. So this is one of my favorite systems in the body. You'll discover that as you move through and learn all the various systems of the body, you'll become familiar with and you'll like some over others. I think part of the reason why I like this so much is quite simply because I worked in that environment for so many years of my life. So, but it is a fascinating system, and the first part we're going to take is the heart. Okay, so of course it's always been discovered that was, you know, sort of this thing that sits in the middle of the chest, sort of all by its lonesome. And during Aristotle's time, he thought that this was the seat of the soul. So the idea was that, you know, the whole expression around love and the shape of the heart and all sorts of things was, you know, early man thought that emotions and the soul itself actually originated in the heart, because when the heart stopped, you died and off your soul went, you know, that belief system. Here's what to think about. The fetal heart begins to pump by day 22 and ends when you die. So if we do the math, okay, at 80 beats per minute, which is considered the norm, at 60 minutes per hour, times 24 hours per day, times 365 days a year, times an average age of 75, in your lifetime, your heart will beat 3,153,600,000 times. Now, I would like to challenge you to take a 4-ounce weight and do 3,153,600,000 bicep curls. And what would happen to your bicep? It would be trashed, right? So think of this heart, this muscle does this and does it quite well. The other thing to think about that is with 3 billion plus heartbeats, they're not always going to be perfect. Does anybody here suffer from any kind of arrhythmia? You know, kind of extra beats and once in a while, sorry? Yeah, I murmur, but nobody here gets little flip-flops in the chest or anything like that at all? Yeah.
I have a friend with an irregular heartbeat taking blood tests or legs.
Yeah. Yeah, so you know, we're going to learn how rhythm gets created in the heart, but you know, to think that there's this many beats in your lifetime, it's quite conceivable that sometimes you'll get some extra ones and you'll miss a few and so forth. But it is a fascinating muscle that it's able to do this in a lifetime. So what's its function? What's it do? It pumps, and it pumps what? Yes, and blood is what? It's a transport fluid. So if we think of blood, we're going to learn when we do the blood lectures, there are two parts to blood. There's the water of blood, and there's the solids of blood. So the solids represent the cells that float in the blood, and then, of course, the water represents the fluid that such said things float in. And so I want you to start thinking of the heart as the pump that pumps this fluid around the body that allows things to travel from one end to the other. It could be nutrients, could be oxygen, could be carbon dioxide. It could be a number of things. But ultimately, all this does is this pumps blood. It ensures that blood moves throughout all the vessels of the body, gets to where it needs to go, and returns again, right, to pick up oxygen, give up carbon dioxide, and start that route all over again, every day, all the time. It is the size of your own fist, so just make a fist, your own fist, your heart is that big. Probably a lot smaller than you realize. Right? You always thought probably it was this big, huge thing, whatever. It's really no bigger than your chest, than your fist in your chest, okay? It weighs between 250 and 350 grams. How many grams in a pound? Close, you're almost there. Should be doing 454, right? A pound is 454. I'm metrically dyslexic. And whenever I'm looking at meat in the counter, I always take 454 and divide it into however big the roast is, and it gives me kind of an idea what it is. So it's not quite a pound. The superior portion is the base, right? And the posterior portion, that should be inferior, I'm so sorry. The superior portion is the base, and the inferior portion is the apex. So meaning it comes to a point, so the upper part is the base, and the lower part is the apex. So I'll start my drawing. Right, so it sits like that. So again, here's the base. It's all about the base. I'm making a joke, right? The song. Right, exactly. Right, so, right, it lies between the two lungs in a space that we now know as the mediastinum, and from the second rib to the fifth intercostal space. So we learned a little bit last week. Where do we find the second rib? How do we landmark for the second rib? The manubrial sternal joint. Remember the manubrial sternal joint, right? So up here is the manubrial. So you got the sternum, the large part here, and you come down below. And where that space, where we'll learn a little bit this next week, but where that joint is a little bit of a line that runs transversely across between the manubrium and the sternum. So if you go straight out to that edge and feel that rib, that's the second rib. Now count down 2, 3, 4, 5 in the space below. So it's probably, for most of you, a recognition that the heart is a lot higher than you realize. Okay? Now here's the thing. The apex of the heart actually lies on the diaphragm. So your diaphragm comes all the way up to there. And your stomach's right below the diaphragm. So your heart sits on top of the diaphragm right above, and your stomach is right below. And for most people, they go, what? Because everybody thinks stomach's down here. You know, lungs go all the way down to your belly button almost and so forth. But it's pretty packed in here. So, like so. And 2/3 of its mass lies to the left of the midline with the apex to the right shoulder. Sorry, the apex to, I got it backwards. Sorry, the apex to the left hip and the base to the right shoulder. So hence the reason why I drew it just like this. Okay, so it actually sits on an angle like this. This will be pointing to the left hip, and this will be pointing to the right shoulder. So it sits on that angle accordingly, all right? So 2/3 of its mass is to the left of the midline with the apex deflected to the left. Therefore, the apex points to the left hip, and the base is directed towards the right shoulder. And as I said, it lies immediately superior to the diaphragm, just like that. So that diaphragm comes all the way up to that fifth intercostal space. Again, probably a lot higher than most of you ever thought the diaphragm actually got. Okay? So it's sitting right just about on top of it. Okay, so like all viscera, this heart has a serous membrane. Remember the serous membranes at the beginning of this semester? Right, the parietal and the visceral. Okay, so the heart has its own serous membranes. And the outer part is the pericardium, and the inner part, of course, right? Remember the serous membrane? Traditionally, there's a part that lies outside the organ and a part that's very intimate to the organ, right? And what's between those two layers? Sorry? Serous fluid in a space. Remember I did the fist in the balloon and it wrapped around? Same thing at the heart. Okay, so there's an inner line to the serous membrane that's very intimately attached, shall we say, to the muscular part of the heart. And then there's an outer layer and there's a space between the two with a fluid that runs between. Okay? Now, there's a third covering, very superficial. It's the most superficial layer of the heart. So we have the two layers, right, on the heart itself with the fluid in between, but we also have a superficial third layer on top of all those, and this is known as the fibrous pericardium. So it is a fibrous type of tissue, right? Now this fibrous pericardium helps protect the heart. It helps anchor the heart in the place where it's supposed to be, and it prevents the heart from overfilling. The heart sits in a very high pressure environment, especially on the left side, right? Blood that is entering into the left side, into the left ventricle, is under very high pressure, and the heart is getting pushed out of it. We're going to learn about a law called Starling's Law here shortly. So the heart is always expanding, right? Getting larger, getting smaller, getting larger, getting smaller. Without that fibrous pericardium, that large would progressively over time with all that pressure just get just like a balloon, just keep filling and filling and filling. So the fibrous pericardium prevents overfilling of the ventricles during its normal function. The serous portion is the parietal pericardium and the visceral pericardium, both collectively known as the epicardium. So we have the fibrous pericardium, which is the third layer, and then those two serous membranes that have the space with the fluid in between, they are known as the epicardium. Okay, fibrous pericardium, most superficial, and then that traditional serous membrane, right? So we'll do this. Okay, so that is your two serous membranes with a little fluid in between, right? A little fluid in between. This is known as the epicardium. Surrounding that is a more fibrous, thicker tissue, as we said, kind of holding everything in place. Okay, and this is the fibrous pericardium. Make sense? If we're going to see here shortly, I do have a video, you're going to see open heart surgery, and you're going to see that when they cut through this, that the fibrous pericardium is actually kind of silvery, white, somewhat opaque, and they have to cut through that before they can get into the next layer to actually get at the heart itself to do any kind of work like a bypass and that kind of stuff. But the heart sits within this. So we say the pericard, so the parietal layer lines the fibrous pericardium, and the epicardium is intimate with the muscular wall of the heart, okay? So we have one part here that's very close to the muscular wall of the heart, one part that attaches onto the fibrous pericardium, and then the fibrous pericardium itself. The space between the parietal and visceral layers is known as the pericardial cavity, right? Now, that pericardial cavity between the visceral and parietal, where I put the little fluid here, it can have a condition where it gets very, very inflamed, and this space will fill up with fluid. Now, if it fills up with fluid and we have a fibrous pericardium, which is, you know, very strong in holding things in place, where's the path of least resistance as fluid builds up in that space? The heart. It'll squeeze the heart until you die. That is called cardiac tamponade. So in certain conditions where you get inflammation of the pericardium, it is known as pericarditis, you can get accumulation of fluid in this space to the point where the heart actually gets squeezed and gets stopped. What they do is they go up under your rib cage with a very large needle, and they penetrate through these two membranes, and they draw the fluid out. It's called a pericardial syntesis, of which I've been in a couple of them, actually, helped the doctors do them a couple of times. So it just helps remove the fluid, the squeeze goes off the heart, they use antibiotics or whatever, you know, medications towards whatever is inflamed, and the patient's usually pretty good to go. So you can see it here. Again, here's your fibrous pericardium. Here's your serous pericardium here, the outer layer. And then, of course, your visceral part of the serous membrane, right, the epicardium is right here, with the space in between. And we can see it here, it's broken away. Here's the muscular wall of the heart. Here's the visceral pericardium here, intimately attached to the muscular wall. Then we have the parietal pericardium here with the space in between the two. And then, of course, surrounding those, and you can see here with the light kind of white wash, shall we call it, this would be the fibrous pericardium that's surrounding all of it. So in other words, your heart sits in a package. It does have a serous membrane like every other organ in your body. And imagine, if you will, that heart is expanding and jiggling all the time in your chest wall while it beats. It has to be in a bit of a semi-liquid slash slippery environment. You don't even notice your heart's beating. But someone who has acute pericarditis, the other side of this is not just filling up with the fluid, it can also get dry. And when it gets dry, every heartbeat feels like a knife going right through your heart. So some individuals get the dryness between those two layers, and every heartbeat's like scratched with sandpaper, and it hurts. So you can get it that way. But you can see here, here's the pericardium here that's inflamed, and you can see you start getting water buildup, and accordingly you can see how it's starting to fill in this area here. And again, the heart starts to get compressed, and that's known as cardiac tamponade. So When we look at the heart, there are three layers. There is what we just took as the epicardium, which is the outer part. Then within the heart itself, of course, I've spoken or related to it a couple times to you, and this is oops, a little too large there. Let's keep that proper, shall we? We have this myocardium, and we have a little bit up here, but we're only going to use the ventricles a little more for that. So I'm just going to make that a little bit red. So in this area here, I'm making it red because it's muscular. Okay? So that is your myocardium. Makes sense? Myo means muscle, and that's what represents the red part. Now, not unlike other parts of the cardiovascular system, we have an inner lining. And the inner lining lines the chambers. And that is known as the endocardium. So we have the pericardium, which is the skin on the outside. The epicardium is not the fibrous pericardium. The epicardium is the two layers of the serous membrane in the space in between, right? So the epicardium is this one here that's attached intimately to the heart muscle. We then have the muscular layer, which is known as the myocardium, and then we have the inner lining, the epithelial tissue that lines the chambers of the heart, and it is known as the endocardium. So far, so good? Yes. Right, correct. It's the one. So because, right, so you still have parietal and visceral. So the epicardium, because it intimately attaches to the heart, is considered an outer layer of the heart, so therefore it's the epicardium. Okay? So three layers. The epicardium is the visceral layer of the serous membrane. And of course, the myocardium is the dense and thickest layer, which is composed of cardiac muscle. Hence why it takes up a fair amount of mass here in the drawing. This is the contractile part of the heart, and the cardiac muscle differentiates from both skeletal and muscle and smooth muscle due to a specialized architecture it has, which we'll talk about a bit later. The specific fibers, though, are tethered to each other by crisscrossing bands of connective tissue. So why would we have that? So if we haven't really done skeletal muscle yet, but understand that when we look at skeletal muscle fibers, they run parallel to each other and they're very linear from one attachment to the other, right? So we'll say this is a tendon attaching one way and this is a tendon attaching the other, and my fingers represent skeletal muscle fibers, and you can see they all run parallel to the longitudinal attachments, right? What we're saying is in cardiac muscle, not only do we have this linear, or sorry, this sort of parallel type of configuration, but we also have cross branches. All right? So they look a little bit like, where are we here? I thought I had a diagram. Isn't that funny? Okay, so but we have these, as I guess this is one later slides for physiology. But understand we have these parallel patterns, but we also have cross bridges. Everybody follow me so far? Why do you think we have that? A little bit of strength. What else? Hold everything in? Is that what you said? Not particularly, because everything's kind of held in. So I'm going to tell you this, and we'll learn this a bit later. Way up here at the top, in this place right here, is where the first initial stimulation for contraction occurs. Okay? Way up here on the top. So the heart, we're going to learn. We take my one hand is top and my other hand is bottom. The heart beats like this. Okay, top, bottom, top, bottom, top, bottom. All right? So it has to travel from here and it goes to a little spot right here. And this one kind of extends down into the myocardium. So we have an initial stimulation that starts here. It travels across the atria to this little place here. And then that stimulation travels into the lower part of the heart for stimulation for muscle contraction. How far does this have to go? Microscopically. So it has to go from here to there. That takes a period of time. It then has to go from here and go all the way down to the bottom and up both sides. So I can take a specific amount of time. So if it just had to travel that straight line, what then would happen to all the muscle cells between the top and the bottom of the lower part? The suggestion would be that the stimulation comes here, stimulates here, which then goes into the upper part of the lower chamber, and then contraction would begin, and you would think initially that the contraction would travel along so that you'd have the contraction occurring here and nothing happening down here. Would that make sense? Well, we can't have that. Because if the top contracts and the bottom isn't, then the efficiency of the contraction to push blood out of the heart becomes very inefficient. We want that lower chamber to contract as one as much as possible. So the first specialization we have is to have these cross bridges, which allows action potentials to travel very quickly throughout all over the place in the lower part. Okay? The second thing is the fibers are arranged in a spiral or circular configuration. Why? What do you do to squeeze the most water out of your washcloth or dishcloth? You wring it. Your heart does the same thing. It doesn't do this, it actually does this. So it's actually squeezing, just like that dishcloth, it's squeezing the last amount of blood that it can out of the chamber. Okay? So Starling's law states that you want a preload, in other words, the muscle wall gets a slight bit of a stretch. So that the same amount that goes in the chamber is the same amount that leaves the chamber. Anything that affects that, too much in, not enough out, then the heart's ability to push blood out gets diminished immensely. So Starling's law, same in, same out, right? So we want then that ability to squeeze as much out so that when it fills in, it gets maximal fill, and then it gets maximal ejection, or the squirting of blood out of the ventricles. We're going to come back to that, so don't worry. So there is a dense network of connective tissue known as the fibroskeleton, which helps reinforce the myocardium. Because what's missing here? If these are all muscle cells, what's missing here compared to skeletal muscle? Sorry? No, there are striations actually in cardiac muscle. There's one very obvious thing that's missing here as compared to skeletal muscle. Bone! There's no bone that's attaching here. Right? So if we need anchors on both ends of a muscle, in order for it to contract or shorten appropriately and affect tension, because really what we are after is high tension when a muscle contracts. What the hell's going on here? Because there's no bone for it to attach to. So we have embedded connective tissue in a network throughout the myocardium and at other parts of the heart, which act as the same as bone to some degree as a skeleton, be it that it's connective tissue, so that there is when the myocardial cells contract. This connective tissue skeleton actually squeezes the heart, and it's actually able to pull it together, and then when it relaxes, it opens back up again. So you do have this connective tissue skeleton within. This skeleton firmly anchors the contractile fibers. It helps reinforce the myocardium, and it also provides additional support for the great vessels. So we're going to also learn that coming out of the top of the heart here, we have big vessels that go into the lungs, for blood to go into the lungs for gaseous exchange. We also have a big vessel that leaves the heart to supply oxygenated blood to all the body. Anybody know what that big vessel is called? The aorta. Okay, the big aorta comes out of here. So they all come out of the top of the heart. So the fibroskeleton also provides support to ensure that those large vessels, they're not flopping over and they can sit quite well in relationship to the heart as well. Okay? The endocardium is a sheet of endothelium, squamous epithelium, which is attached to a layer of connective tissue, a basement membrane. So this pink part here is the endothelium, and it does share the basement membrane with part of the myocardium. Remember the basement membrane when we're thinking of epithelial tissue, right? We had our layers of cells in epithelial tissue, then we had a basement membrane, then we had the connective tissue layer underneath, correct? So the same thing's happening here. The epithelial cells of the endothelium are layered, right? So what's it called? It is squamous epithelium, right? And it's actually stratified because it's not about absorption and secretion. So it's stratified. So as we get into the lower layers of the epithelium, we do have the basement membrane, and then the basement membrane attaches to the connective tissue that's part of the fibrous skeleton within the myocardium. So far, so good. Now, this endothelium lines the four chambers of the heart and is the same endothelial layer that lines all the vessels of the cardiovascular system. I liken it to Teflon. So it's slippery, deliberately slippery. Now, blood likes to clot, right? Anybody know any of the mechanisms which causes clotting? Know anything that stimulates blood to clot? Yeah, exposure to the outside air. So you cut yourself, the blood gets exposed to air, it clots. The other thing is if blood stops. If blood is stopped, it clots. So when I used to work in the butcher shop, in the slaughterhouse, when we bled a cow out, if we wanted to use that blood to make like blood pudding or something like that, we had to take the blood that was in the container and stir it. Oh, you ever had blood pudding? Good stuff. Blood pudding. So many cultures make blood pudding. Right. So many cultures make blood pudding. China, South America, Europe, they're made everywhere. It's delicious. You got to try it. So you stir it so it doesn't clot. Right? So the one thing we don't want is to have an environment that blood's traveling through in the vessels where it gets caught and stops because boom, boom, boom. Next thing you know, we're building a clot, and that clot can go somewhere into a small artery somewhere in the brain, and we get a stroke. Okay? The other thing that blood doesn't like, which causes it to clot, is turbulence. So I want you to think of blood flowing in the vessels, just like the water in a river, right? You've got bifurcations, so the river splits and it comes back again and so forth. Your blood's exactly the same way, right? We've got vessels that bifurcate and then bifurcate again, like splitting all over the place. So the last thing we want at those splits is to have blood cells bump into it, and then you get currents and eddies, and blood would go, "I don't like that," and you get a clot, and that would be the problem. Okay? So we need this endothelial layer, this Teflon layer, this highly slippery layer, so that as the blood flows, it flows smoothly, effortlessly, doesn't stop, doesn't get turbulent, and you're good to go. Okay? Here's the problem. Artificial hearts. Why have we not invented an artificial heart yet? If you think of the heart as being a pump, I think the pump part's pretty easy. We can invent a pump, no problem. Just little things, mechanisms, move blood along. We've already created that. We created the first heart pump, I think it was in 71 or 72, something like that. Here's the problem. It's not the pump that's the problem. It's what the chambers of the pump are lined with that's the problem. We haven't yet come up with something good enough that represents like this endothelial layer. So most people who get a heart pump, an artificial heart, survive for a period of time and then they clot. And then that clot goes off and ends up in a stroke or whatever. And then the individual gets compromised. And in some cases, well, all cases, they end up dying. Could be from infection, but quite often it's from clots that form because the pump, yes, pumps blood really well, but doesn't provide that environment where blood's comfortable and feeling okay and doesn't want to clot. That's usually the problem. So, got a lot of layers here to think about. We have an outer fibrous pericardium. We have a serous membrane, both parietal and visceral, that are underneath that. The visceral layer is known as the epicardium. Then we have the myocardium. Then we have the endocardium, which is the pink on the inside. And as I said, the endocardium not only lines the heart, it also lines all the vessels throughout the entire cardiovascular system. So we can see it here. Here's our endocardium here, our myocardium here, and you can see this areolar tissue and basement membrane here kind of being shared. Here is our pericardium here, or our visceral serous layer with the space in between, and then the parietal layer outside, and then the fibrous layer on top of that. And you can kind of see it here. This is a cadaver looking at it. So they have taken the heart and cut it open. This deep red layer represents the myocardium, the muscular layer of the heart. You can see a tissue being pulled here on the right, which is the epicardium or the visceral pericardium. And then you can see the endocardium here being pulled away on the inside of the chamber of the heart. Okay? That's another nice piece of meat to eat. Beef heart? It's good stuff. Anybody here had beef heart before? It's good. Chambers. So I've already talked about them here. There's a couple of them. So there's, I'll number them this way. Because there are one, two, we'll call those A, that represent the two upper chambers. And then there are one, two, and we'll call these B, and they are the two lower chambers. So there are two upper chambers and two lower chambers. There are four chambers in total, and there are two superior and two inferior. The two superior chambers are called the atria, and the two inferior chambers are called the ventricles, okay? Both the superior and inferior chambers are divided by a wall called a septum. So right here, this area here, represents a septum that separates the two ventricular walls, and then I have a little thin line here, and this is a septum that separates the two atrial walls. So we have four divided chambers in the heart, two upper, two lower, and they are both upper and lower divided by a septum. The septum that divides the ventricles is known as the interventricular septum, and the septum that divides the two atria is known as the intraatrial septum. How am I doing? Am I going fast? Okay. Is that because I'm drawing or? See, I can teach this in my sleep, this one. Any questions? So key things here. Layers. Go know your layers. Fibrous, parietal, visceral, space in between, fluid, right? Muscular layer, endothelial layer, right? Slippery, helps the blood through. Four chambers, two atria superiorly, two ventricles inferiorly. There are walls that divide them into right and left. Those are, of course. Thank you. She was talking to me. Do you want to ignore it? I'm like, yeah, I want to ignore it. The right ventricle forms most of the anterior portion of the heart, and the left ventricle dominates the inferoposterior aspect, forming the apex. So the apex lower part is represented by the ventricles, and then the base is represented by the two atria. You can see them there in that drawing, probably a lot better drawing than mine. Here's your two ventricles, here and here. Right ventricle, left ventricle, and then of course we have an atria, right atrium, left atrium. You can see the interventricular septum here, but in behind the great vessels underneath these would be the septum that divides the atria, the intraatrial septum that divides that into right and left atria. You can see them here as well in the diagrams. There's a couple here. Here is all kind of laid out for you with labels. But ultimately, here we go. Here is our right atria here. Here is our left, Here is your right ventricle here. Here is your left ventricle here. Left atria, right atria. Here is your intraatrial septum that we can see here. Here is your interventricular septum that we can see here. So in other words, there are four separate chambers. You'll note that I use the term right and left all the time. When we look at the heart, the right side is interconnected and the left side is interconnected. Is the right ever connected to the left that you can see in either of those diagrams? No, there is no connection between right and left. So when we look at a heart and its relationships, we always talk about right side heart and left side heart because the right atria communicates with the right ventricle and the left atria communicates with the left ventricle, and no, not ever do the atria intercommunicate or the ventricles intercommunicate? So there's always the right heart and the left heart. I'll jump a little bit ahead and say the right heart is the part of the heart that's accepting low oxygen blood, right? So the right side is accepting blood that's coming back to the heart, having given up its oxygen, and coming back with a load of carbon dioxide. The left side of the heart is accepting oxygenated blood that's going to take blood that's coming back from the lungs that has been oxygenated, and it's going to pump that oxygenated blood out to the body to feed the body with the oxygenated blood for all the cells and all the tissues throughout the body that require it in order to function properly. Okay, so right side, left side, never a mix between right and left, except inside mom. It's the only time. So when fetus is inside mom, there is a bit of a hole between the right and left atria where there is mixing of blood. Why? Well, riddle me this. When we think of in the human adult, deoxygenated blood enters the right side of the heart, and then that blood deoxygenated goes into the lungs where there's gases exchange, carbon dioxide out, oxygen in. And then that blood that's been oxygenated travels down to the left atria, then to the left ventricle, where the left ventricle then pumps the oxygenated blood out to the body. In fetal circulation, we have to have exchange. And where is the oxygen coming from in the fetus? Sorry? Yeah, from? So what's missing as compared to the adult in the fetus? Yeah, they're not breathing and exchanging oxygen that way. So we don't want blood to travel that way in the fetus because the lungs are kind of useless at this point because they're inside mom. So we have this opening which allows that exchange to occur via mom's umbilical system and herself, breathing and so forth. So this is why it's there. And then when we're going to learn that when we're born, there are some chemical changes that occur, and within an hour, that hole between the two atria closes up. And then the baby is exchanging blood and gases just like normal. Sometimes that goes wrong, though. Sometimes you have a heart murmur because you have a hole between two chambers. Yep, there you go. So, there are two grooves on the superficial surface of the heart, which represents the boundaries of the chambers. So this is a real heart, and you can see here, this is the anterior aspect of the heart, and we can see it up here a little bit closer. So you can see there's a kind of a groove here where these vessels are traveling through and a bit of fat. You can see it here as well, and that represents the boundary between the two chambers. So this anterior portion here, this line, this anterior interventricular sulcus running down through here, is separating the left ventricle on this side and the right ventricle on this side. And so underneath this groove right here is the interventricular septum. There is also a line that runs around here like this, and that line here, and you can kind of see it running through here, it's kind of a circle that goes around. That groove represents the boundary between the atria above and the ventricles below. And then there's just a little bit of a line up through here between the atria, sort of up this way a little bit. You can't quite see it because of the pulmonary trunk. And that represents underneath it the septum between the two atria. So there are two grooves on the superficial surface of the heart which represent the boundaries of these chambers. A groove is known as a sulcus, and in the heart, these carry the blood vessels that supply the myocardium. So, again, to remember for just a little bit down the road, the myocardium, the blood supply that supplies the muscle of the heart, travels on the superficial surface of the heart. So for all the blood that travels through the chambers of the heart on any given minute, that blood in the chambers doesn't feed the needs of the heart at all. That blood actually leaves the chambers, then goes through vessels which run on the surface of the heart, which then supplies the myocardium from the surface. Okay? The coronary sulcus represents the demarcation between the atria and the ventricles and encircles the heart. And because it encircles the heart, it's called coronary, which means crown-like. So the fact that that sulcus, that coronary sulcus, travels around above the ventricles. It's the one that represents the atria above and the ventricles below. And because it goes around the heart like a crown, hence the name coronary, which means crown-like. The anterior interventricular sulcus represents the anterior portion of the interventricular septum and holds the anterior interventricular artery. We'll be coming back to that artery. Yep. The anterior interventricular sulcus, so the ditch or the groove that runs on the anterior part of the heart, which we can see right here. Underneath that represents the anterior portion of the interventricular septum, and what runs along there is the anterior interventricular artery. So that groove that runs across the front is dividing the two ventricles, left here, right there, and the anterior interventricular artery and vein both run through there, and you can see it up closer here. So you've got the sulcus that's running here, and you can see how there's a bit of fat, and you see how it deepens here, right? So this is the artery, and this would be the vein. And it is supplying the myocardium from the superficial surface of the heart. Correct. So that's the blood supply for the myocardium of the heart. So suddenly I got a really sedentary lifestyle and a really crappy processed foods at McDonald's all the time. I get buildup of fat and crap in my artery, and suddenly it plugs and I have a heart attack. Myocardial infarction. It's because one of these arteries, or these little tiny branches here, gets a clot in it, and whatever part of the myocardium that supplies starts to die because it's not getting any oxygen. And that's a heart attack. And we're going to come back to that, trust me. Okay? The posterior interventricular sulcus is the posterior equivalent to the anterior interventricular sulcus. In other words, there's a sulcus that runs on the anterior part of the heart that divides the right and left ventricles. There's also a sulcus on the back side of the heart that divides the left and the right ventricles. So the anterior one, of course, is the anterior interventricular sulcus, and the posterior one is the posterior interventricular sulcus. Okay? So let's talk about these atria. They represent the receiving chambers. So they receive blood from one of two places. The right one receives blood from the body, meaning torso, legs, arms, neck, and head. The left atria accepts blood from the pulmonary system that's returning back after having gone through the lungs. So the right represents all the returning blood from the body, and the left represents returning blood from the pulmonary system or from the lungs. So the receiving chambers. Sitting on top of the atria are two ear-like appendages called the auricles, and that's all I'm going to say about that. They look like dog ears. They kind of sit on top. They're kind of semi-functional, but not really. They're probably a leftover evolutionarily, but I don't spend a whole lot of time on them because they don't play a lot of role in what we need to know. From a surface observation, they're somewhat indistinguishable. You can kind of see it there. See, it's just like this little flap that sits on top. I do believe it's an evolutionary leftover from something. I'm not sure what, as far as that goes. I'm sure if I looked it up, I might be able to find it. Yeah, right there, that little liver thing, the little flap. See, it looks like a dog's ear. This kind of hangs over top. See it right there? So it's just like this little flap that just kind of hangs there. The configuration of the muscle, posteriorly, at the posterior aspect of the atria, there are muscles in here. Not so much on the anterior surface, more on the posterior surface. When looked at under a microscope, they look like the tooth of a comb. The way they line up, they look like the tooth of a comb. Therefore, they are called pectinate muscles. Pectinate means like the teeth of a comb. Okay? So we find these pectinate muscles in the posterior aspects of these atria. You can see them back here. Here's the right atrium here. You're looking with the anterior cut away on the coronal cut. Here we see the right atrium here, and we can see a little bit of the left atrium here. Now, right off the top, in every drawing you'll ever get in your anatomy book, I said the right side is representing deoxygenated blood from the body, so it is colored blue. And the left side is accepting oxygenated blood from the lungs, so therefore it is red. So from here on in, any picture you look at of a human body in the cardiovascular system, anything that is blue is deoxygenated, and everything that is red is oxygenated. Okay? Oxygenated blood is always traveling away from the heart, and deoxygenated blood is always traveling to the heart, except, and I'll get back to that. I don't want to confuse you too much. Not yet. So, the left atrium has a greater percentage of smooth wall as compared to the right, and that's because it's under greater pressure. The other thing I want you to take away is that the right side of the heart is low pressure, and the left side is high pressure. That goes all the way to the vessels. Arteries are under high pressure, and veins are under low pressure. So we have adaptations accordingly, right? Structure governs function, or function governs structure. So because it's high pressure on the left side, we have bigger muscular walls to deal with the pressure. On the right side, because we have less pressure, we don't see the same kind of adaptation of thick muscular walls because they're really not required. Okay? So, left atrium has a greater percentage of smooth wall as compared to the right. There is a shallow depression on this interatrial septum, and this is known as the fossa ovalis. So you kind of have this little kind of depression there, okay? This fossa represents the closure of a foramen that once existed during fetal development. So the fossa ovalis is when it's closed. When you're inside mom and it's opened, it is known as the foramen ovale. And this is that exchange I was talking about when you're inside mom and you don't have the lungs and you're getting your oxygen from mom. So in the adult, it looks like this. In the fetus, or in a born child, a born human, in a fetus is actually a hole like that. And you actually do get deliberate exchange right and left in fetal circulation. The atria are small and thin-walled as compared to the ventricles due to their mostly passive influence on blood flow. So we're going to learn that there's a space here where blood will leave the atria and go into the ventricles, whether it's from the right or from the left. It makes no difference. I'm going to close this back up again just so you don't get confused. Okay? Now, the heart sits like this, with the atria at the top and the ventricles at the bottom. Is it fair to say that this organ may be influenced by gravity? Yes. So if I have an atria full of blood and I open the floor of that container, what's going to happen to the blood under the influence of gravity? It's just going to dump into the ventricle. The majority of blood in the atria is passive, which means that when the valve on the floor of the atria opens up, the majority of blood just drops into the container even before the atria even begin to contract. The majority drops in. And then the atria contracts and pushes the rest of it out. Okay? Everybody follow me on that? Yes, no, maybe? Okay? So we say it is passive. The right atrium receives blood via three veins, the inferior vena cava, the superior vena cava, and the coronary sinus. The inferior vena cava is returning blood from all areas below the heart itself, which includes the torso, abdominal pelvic region, and the lower limbs. The superior vena cava is returning blood from the upper limbs, upper thorax, neck, and head. And the coronary sinus is returning blood from the heart circulation itself. So lower body, upper body, the heart's own circulatory system of those superficial vessels which are feeding it. Because remember, we have to have arteries that go out to the myocardium when we need veins to come back. Everything inferior to the heart. So if the heart is sitting on top of the diaphragm, that would mean the inferior vena cava is basically feeding from below that. So if I were to do this, okay, I'm going to open this up a little bit. This is the superior vena cava, and this is the inferior vena cava. So this is coming up from everything below, and this is coming down from everything above. And then back here, there's a little hole back here, and this is the coronary sinus where deoxygenated blood is returning back from the heart's own circulation on that superficial surface. Little more complicated than you thought, huh? But it's so cool. I just think it's so cool. The heart's amazing. Any questions? I'm asking that question because I don't know what to do with my clicker. Oh, crazy. Okay. There are four pulmonary veins that enter the left atrium, which makes up most of the heart's base. So we've got here, we've got one, two, three, and four. So four vessels. Coming back from pulmonary circulation, right? They're returning blood back in. So if I were to do this, then we can, a little less confusion, we can go blue this way, blue this way. And then we can go red this way. That makes sense now? Okay, so this is coming back from the lungs. This is all coming back from the body and then the heart itself. So blue on this side, on the right, red on the left. Okay? And by the way, anytime you want, you can bring your camera up and take a picture. I don't mind it being taken pictures of. It doesn't bother me any, so. All right? So, we can see it here and there at this drawing. So we've got the inferior vena cava here, the superior vena cava here. We have the cardiac sinus here, the coronary sinus here. So upper body, lower body, heart circulation. And then on this side, we have the four pulmonary veins that are returning back to the heart with the aorta. Now we have a problem here. What the hell? Those are red, but it's called a what? PV stands for pulmonary vein. How the hell is that possible? It's oxygenated blood, but they're calling it a vein. The definition is anything that is returning blood back to the heart is called a vein, and anything that is conducting blood away from the heart is called an artery. It is the only two vessels that are named opposite to the rest of the system. Because the pulmonary veins are returning blood to the heart, even though it's oxygenated, they're called pulmonary veins. And the blood that leaves the right atria, the right ventricle, that's going to send blood to the pulmonary system are called pulmonary arteries because they're conducting blood away from the heart, but the blood is deoxygenated. So the pulmonary artery is the only artery in the body that carries deoxygenated blood, and the pulmonary veins are the only veins that carry oxygenated blood away from the heart. I'll give you a minute to type that down. The oxygen, no, so yes, so right, because going away from the heart is an artery and going to the heart is a vein. So the pulmonary artery is carrying deoxygenated blood and the pulmonary veins are carrying oxygenated blood. Correct. Hence the reason why they're called pulmonary. Yep, correct. Dear Lord, eh? Any questions? No. Right, because you'll see it's actually drawn red there, isn't it? Yes. No, two. Veins always carry blood to the heart. Arteries conduct blood away from the heart. Okay, can I move on? Any questions? You can see here is the foraminal valley that's opened up. This would be normal fetal circulation. And as I said, what happens when you're born, through chemical reactions with the presence of oxygen, this snaps shut. Now, in some humans, this doesn't. And it has a variation of opening. It can stay fully open, or it can only be partially open. So what ends up resulting in is called an intraseptal defect, and this results in something called a heart murmur, where it means that when the physician listens to the heart sounds, lub-dub, 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 there's an extra sound. So if it's an intraatrial septal defect, you hear lub-sh-dub, 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 because it's squirting through that hole where it's not supposed to. If it's an intraventricular septal defect, because you can get a hole in your septum between your ventricles, it goes lub-dub-sh, 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 because, again, you're getting leaking and crossing over, right? But for now, because we have this foraminal valley, right, it stays open, as I said, during fetal circulation, but then closes once the child is born. So you can see, again, here's the right atrium, here's the coronary sinus. This is a couple of your pulmonary veins returning blood in. We can see this is the posterior aspect of the heart. We can see here's the coronary sinus. A sinus in the venous system, when you hear the term sinus, it's a big floppy bag that's a vessel. So you have a sinus in your brain that's collecting deoxygenated blood. It's just this really thin walled sac that holds blood in. And then you have another one here in your in the back part of your heart. And this is all, and you can see here in this nice drawing, you can see the arteries and the veins. So this is the posterior interventricular sulcus here with the posterior interventricular vein and artery. And you can see how all the red's going out, of course, to feed the myocardium. And all the blue is deoxygenated blood that's collecting in the coronary sinus to enter into the right atria to head off to the lungs to do gaseous exchange. Questions? So, the ventricles. Venter means underside. So, these are the lower chambers. They make up the majority of the mass of the heart, and even in my drawing, you can see it, you know, ventricles are quite a bit larger than the atria. The ventricle's whole responsibility is to pump blood out of the heart. So, whether that's blood heading out of the heart to go to pulmonary circulation, or whether that's blood heading out of the heart to go and feed the rest of the body. The ventricles are all about pumping blood out. The myocardium on the left ventricle is much more dense as compared to the right. And you'll note I try to draw it that way as well, that a lot more thickness and a smaller chamber here on the left, a lot thinner, a bit of a larger chamber here on the right. So the left ventricle is much more dense because it's having to do what? The left ventricle is pumping blood where? The whole body. So it's got to pump it to the whole body. And it provides a lot of pressure. And you know what that pressure is because you've been measuring it. Which number is it in the blood pressure? Correct. Which is what? It's a normal number? 120 millimeters of mercury at sea level. You probably have never heard that before, have you? That's what MMHG stands for. 120 millimeters of blood are mercury, because the old blood pressure cuffs used to have a column of mercury, right, that we pump and the mercury would go up. So that means that the ventricle then, and what's the lower number, by the way? And what that represent? Right, so there's existing pressure in the system, on the atrial system at all times, correct? Okay, so 120 represents the amount of pressure their left ventricle needs to create in order to push blood out of the ventricle to the body. And 80 represents the existing pressure in the system that the left ventricle has to overcome in order to push blood out of its chamber. Does that make sense? If we don't get to 120, blood ain't leaving the heart, fundamentally. Okay? So that's what you're measuring. How much pressure is in the system and how much pressure is required, right? And 120 over 80 is considered the norm. Okay? Anything that affects that can result in higher lower numbers or higher upper numbers, depending. And we won't get into that until a little bit later when I won't see you guys for path one, but I talk a lot about hypertension in path one. And it's just because there's a lot of reasons why it can happen. But just understand that that's what's happening. So the myocardium on the left ventricle is much more dense as compared to the right because it needs to overcome this existing pressure in the left side of the system. The right ventricle pumps blood into the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary circulation, while the left pump ejects blood into the aorta. And I want you to get into that terminology. When the heart beats and blood leaves, it's called ejection because it's like, phew. And what we look at when we're looking at hearts and whether or not they're functioning properly, you have something called an echocardiogram. Anybody here had an echocardiogram? And what they're measuring is the ejection fraction. So how much when the ventricle contracts, is it a good ejection fraction? In other words, is the ventricle sufficiently pumping blood out of the heart? And one of the things that you're going to learn about is called heart failure, where that ventricle gets weak for some reason. Maybe there's been a myocardial infarction and part of the muscle's died and it's not ejecting properly. But think of it as a squirting out, so it's ejecting. It's ejecting blood out every time it beats, okay? The left side must overcome greater back pressure as compared to the right. Therefore, the larger muscle mass, which I said it has to overcome that existing 80, get to 120 in order to move blood around. On the interior surface of the ventricles, they ain't smooth. They're not smooth. A lot of people have the impression they're not, but they're not. There are ridges of muscle within these chambers, and in the ventricles, these ridges are called trabeculae carnae. And you can see them there. See, that's a ventricle, and see, it's not smooth-walled, is it? Now, there's a few other things we haven't talked about yet, but you can see that there are all these big, thick, muscular ridges. Those are your trabeculae carnae. Now, arising from the interior surface are cone-shaped muscles called the papillary muscles, which prevent the valves from inverting like an inverted umbrella. I'm about to rub this off. If you want to take a picture of it, you can do so now, and then before I rub it off. All throughout. Interior is correct. So within the chamber are these big solid tubes of muscle. You can come down if you want to. Oh, I guess everybody's got super duper heavy duty. Can see a flea on the tip of a hair from 100 yards type of cameras. Do you know there's a whole movement happening right now on CBC? They were talking about it where people are moving away and going to basic phones again. Like just a flip phone with no camera and all that kind of stuff. Oh, great. Yeah, all of you are going to have brain cancer when you get old with all the phones you've had stuck to your head all your lives. I didn't buy my first cell phone until I was 42. I just didn't understand the purpose of them. I always had, though, a pager. Okay, this is good. It can come off. I want to get rid of this silly thing too. How do I get rid of that? I'll leave it for later. Almost. Let me finish the thought. Okay, so we've got a couple things we're going to talk about here shortly. We've got this division between the atria and the ventricles. And we said that when if the blood in the atria goes into the ventricles, it basically passively fills. In other words, it drops down into the ventricle. And I said that is when the door opens or the floor opens and the blood falls out. What's the door that's opening? So between the atria and the ventricles, we have valves like so. All right? So that when they open, of course, blood is going to travel in this direction in both cases, okay? Into those chambers. So we say that we have these trabeculae carinae, which are these bands of muscle, but we also have something called papillary muscles. So on the surface, what does papillary mean? You know it. We've talked about it. It's come in other things. Papillary is a nipple-like projection. Okay? So, arising from the interior surface are cone-shaped muscles called the papillary muscles, and these prevent the valves from turning inside out when they contract. So we're going to discover that on the tips of these papillary muscles, we have these tendons that attach to the flaps. And they prevent those flaps from turning inside out and coming up into the atria. So that when the ventricle contracts, the papillary muscles contract, pulling on that tendon that holds the flap so that when blood is under pressure and trying to head back to where it came from, those green flaps close, pressure rises, and because those papillary muscles are pulling on it, that flap won't turn inside out like an umbrella. And we'll come back to that in a bit, but understand that it is these extensions and these tendons that run out there that prevent those flaps from turning the other way when there's contraction. And you can see them here. Here are the papillary muscles kind of here, but they're better served here. So you can see the cords here that are attaching on the edges of this valve flap here. All these cords are coming off these big nipple-like projections that are coming up here, and these tendons are preventing the flaps from turning inside out. Okay? All right, take a break. See you guys at 5:02. Okay, let's continue. Can find there. Okay. So we have these trabeculae carinae here, these big, thick bundles, and then these papillary muscles. We can see here, this is the heart open basically right down the center and separated. So we can see here the right ventricle, and we can see these papillary muscles here that are extending upwards with these tendons that are related to the flaps of the valve. And then we can see these thick trabeculae carinae. Again, one thing to take away is these chambers are not large and smooth and open. They actually have a lot of stuff going on inside with these papillary muscles and these trabeculae carinae. So now, how does blood travel through the heart? So I've alluded to it a couple times. As I said, the chambers do not relate to each other laterally, but in fact relate vertically. Right ventricle, right atria articular connects with right ventricle, left atria works with left ventricle, and never do we have laterality where right and left kind of work together, right? They're different. So in other words, then, we can think of the heart as a two-sided pump. That is, the right pump serves the pulmonary trunk, which allows blood to exchange gases at the alveoli capillary beds, And of course, the left side serves systemic circulation. That is, it ensures that oxygenated blood gets to and travels throughout the body. So right is all about sending blood to the lungs. Left is all about sending blood to the body. So how does it work? You can write this down if you want, or use the slide. So I'm going to use red here. So we're saying blood depleted in oxygen but high in carbon dioxide enters into the right atria. So I'm just going to do this. One, two, three, four. We're saying that, so we'll use blue here. So blue blood, of course, then is heading into the right atria. Accordingly, okay? So, blood depleted in oxygen but high in carbon dioxide enters the right atria. Blood from the right atrium enters into the right ventricle. So all this blood then travels into this right atria. The right ventricle pumps blood out into pulmonary circulation via the pulmonary arteries to allow for exchange of gases. So we're going to just do this. Right, so that's going, we've got a lung here and a lung here. So again, it's entered into the right atria and then into the right ventricle, and then blood, of course, and exits the right ventricle and heads out to pulmonary circulation, of course, going right and left. Of course, right lung, left lung, right? So the right ventricle pumps blood out into pulmonary circulation to allow for the exchange of gases. We then have the return of oxygenated blood. So we have oxygenated blood returning from pulmonary circulation via the pulmonary veins enters the left atrium. So we've got blood kind of coming into the left atrium via the pulmonary veins. Blood left from the left atria enters into the left ventricle. Blood then from the is ejected out of the left ventricle into the aorta to travel along smaller and smaller vessels out in circulation. So again, we have this aorta kind of travels accordingly, like so, so that we have blood that's left the left ventricle and it's heading out into systemic circulation, like so. So blood is ejected out of the left ventricle into the aorta to travel along smaller and smaller arteries to exchange gases at the tissue capillary beds, where, of course, oxygen is released and carbon dioxide is then picked up. Then traveling along larger and larger, so it's from very small veins of the capillary to larger and larger and larger vessels, deoxygenated blood returns back to the right atrium. Right? So you'll note that on the arterial side, blood starts in big vessels and gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And on the venous side, the deoxygenated blood starts in small vessels and gets larger and larger and larger as it gets to the right atria. Okay? So we can see here in the diagram as well. You can see it doing exactly what I talked about here. So, of course, these two represent the two lungs. But you can see it here in the numbers. So, right atria, right ventricle, pulmonary arteries, pulmonary veins into the right left atria, left ventricle, aorta to go out into systemic circulation. Okay? Might be a picture in your quiz next week where you actually have to draw the path of blood. That'd be kind of a cool question. Oh, it's a test next week, right? Oh, maybe I'll put it on the test. No, I won't do that. I won't do that. So, I'll just show it to you quickly. This is a nice animation that you can look at. So it's kind of showing you how when the heart's beating, you can see the two atria at the top, the two ventricles here, and the valves and whatever. And you're going to come back to this because we're going to talk about how the valves work in terms of forcing blood to move in the direction we want it to. But you can see in this animation, again, it's kind of neat. You can download it too. I think there's a link below where you can download this and then get a big picture of it. But it's just a really cool way to look at how it's all kind of working. It's a great animation. So when we think of this pathway and we look at the two of them, a couple things we can say. First, equal volumes of blood are pumped into both the pulmonary and systemic systems at any one time. So even though I said that the left side is in high pressure and the right side's in low, we still get equal amounts of blood that enter and exit, whether it's into the atria or out of the ventricles. Oh, did someone leave the charger? Oh, okay. All right, so it's the same. The right side has much less work to do if we compare it to the left. The right side is a low pressure environment, whereas the left side is a much higher pressure system. Why? Anybody know here any of the laws of resistance and that kind of stuff? So, you probably don't. When blood leaves the left side, you now know it's 120 millimeters of mercury at blood pressure, right? So that's the pressure blood's after. I'm then going to jump ahead and say that when the blood goes through systemic circulation, you know, travels where it needs to go arterial-wise to go feed tissues. By the time that blood gets back to the heart, the pressure is, anybody want to guess? Almost zero. Okay? There's virtually no pressure in the blood by the time it gets back to the right atrium. The question is, why? Robert might be able to help me here because I can't remember the name of this law. So, There is a law out there that I want you to picture this. So I can take a faucet at your house, an outside faucet, and I put a hose on it. I can put a long enough hose on that faucet that eventually no water will come out. What's happened? Do you remember the law? I can't remember it either. I always forget the name of it. What happens is, as the water travels along the hose, the walls of the hose press resistance down on the water. Now, water has a particular pounds per square inch when it comes out of the faucet. Don't ask me what it is. I don't know what it is, but it's high. Okay? I don't know what it is. I really don't. I don't know. Is it 55 pounds per square inch or something like that? I don't know what it is. But ultimately, I'd have to have a hell of a long hose. Don't get me wrong. I'd really have to have a long hose. But I could, because of the law, I could put a hose that's long enough that there's not enough pressure in the faucet that would allow water to come out the end of the hose. In other words, the accumulated friction on the walls of the hose eventually accumulate to equal the pressure that's coming out of the faucet. So therefore, there's no net movement of water. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. So how's that different than blood traveling through vessels in the body? Because as the oxygenated blood travels through all the arteries and arterioles and capillary beds that it travels through, and then all the venules and veins as it gets back to the heart, all those vessels have been adding up resistance on the blood as it moves. So by the time the blood gets back to the heart, all that accumulated resistance is greater than 120 millimeters of mercury at level. So in fact, we have modifications on the venous side because it diminishes so quickly, it's difficult if we didn't have some of these modifications for blood to actually get back to the heart. So we're going to learn that on the venous side, there's actually valves that prevent blood from trying to get back down to your feet, shall we say. And then on top of that, every time you breathe, your diaphragm milks your inferior vena cava, pushing blood up towards the heart, and every time you move, every muscle contraction is just squeezing those veins, pushing blood upwards. So we have these modifications, but what I want you to understand is that On the left side, we've created this 120 millimeters of mercury upon ejection and a consistent resting pressure of 80 millimeters of mercury at sea level. Whereas on the venous side, by the time we get back to the right atria, we almost have no pressure at all. So when we say then, the right side has much less work to do if we do compared to the left. The right side is a low pressure environment, whereas the left is a much higher. The blood encounters 5 times more friction and quite a number of vessels to move the blood through. So all those vessels that the blood needs to move through provides friction that bleeds the pressure off the blood as it works its way through the body. Okay? This extra work is why the myocardium is much thicker and the chamber is much larger as compared to the right. Now, the right ventricle partially encloses the left. Why? Why do you think that would happen? So the right is giving the left a hug. Why? Yeah. So because both ventricles contract at the same time, so the right is just providing a little bit of more to help the left to get the blood out. Okay? There was a procedure that was attempted a number of years ago with heart failure where if people had really diminished cardiac output because of left ventricular damage due to a heart attack, they would actually, I don't know where whatever happened to it, but they would actually take a piece of pectoralis major and wrap it around the ventricles. And then put a wire on it like a pacemaker that it would stimulate that pectoralis major to contract along with the myocardium, and they thought that it would just give that little more increase in cardiac output. Don't know if it's done very often anymore. I don't think it quite worked out the way they wanted it to, but I thought it was a cool idea. So, as we can imagine, a large volume of blood passes through the heart, right? All this blood goes through. Your entire blood volume passes through the heart every minute. And how much blood do we have? Anybody, do I have it on there somewhere? No. Just a little over 5 liters. How much is that? Yes. How much is that? For those of us who remember, think of 5 bags of milk. So if you buy a 3 bag of milk, they're a liter each. So think of 5 of those bags plus a little more. And that's how much goes through your heart every minute. Okay? Every minute. It's cool, eh? Even though all this blood travels through the chambers, the actual tissues of the heart or of the myocardium don't get any of it. Right? The tissues of the heart are served via the coronary circulation, which we somewhat alluded to when we were looking at the sulci. The coronary supply is provided by the right and left coronary arteries. Both of these arteries encircle the heart within the coronary sulcus. We already talked about the sulci, which is the anterior interventricular sulci and the posterior interventricular sulci. We also had the coronary sulcus as well that went around all the way around the heart like a crown, and you can kind of see it here. That's the anterior view here, and this is the posterior view here. And you can see how the artery and the vein run through these sulci together. Of course, one distributing blood to the cells of the myocardium, and the other one returning deoxygenated blood back to the heart from the cells of the myocardium. So the left coronary artery runs towards the left side of the heart, and then it then divides into the anterior interventricular artery, and this is clinically known as the left anterior descending artery. I'm going to rub this off. Anybody need to take a picture of it? Going once, going twice. Okay. I'll step out of the picture. Yeah, that's right. I'm not photogenic. Okay. It looks a bit like a bum. Which one over here? Okay. So we're saying that we have this right and left coronary artery. So this represents the base of the aorta. In other words, where the proximal portion of the aorta exits out of the left ventricle. Okay, so the left ventricle is not in this picture. I've got the valves here, which we'll get to shortly. But this is what the aorta looks like if I were to remove the heart and everything around it. All right, so this is the proximal portion of the aorta. Of course, because I drew it too far away, that aorta then is going to arch back towards the spine and travel down to feed the thorax, and then it splits into two down by your belly button to feed the two legs and so forth, right? There's all these, you know, little branches that come off here and there, and other ones to the front and all over the place, right? Feeding all sorts of things as it works its way down. So right here where left ventricle, you'll see there is the left and the right coronary arteries, okay? So they're going to feed them. So when I say the left coronary artery runs towards the left side of the heart where it divides into the anterior interventricular artery, which you've already talked about a couple of times, it's more clinically known as the left anterior descending or the LAD. Anybody who's done any work for a doctor and heart reports, you always see LAD is pretty much the common with cardiologists. This artery follows the anterior interventricular septum and the anterior walls of both ventricles. So we already talked a little bit about anterior interventricular sulcus. So this LAD, okay, is running down that anterior interventricular sulcus. The other branch that divides out of the left coronary artery is the circumflex artery, and it travels in the circumflex sulcus, circumflex meaning it goes around, crown-like, right? So it supplies the left atrium and the posterior wall of the left ventricle. So far, so good? And yes, you do need to know this, and I do ask questions on this. So here we go. Here's a little more anatomically correct. Here's the aorta and its branches. We can see the proximal portion of the aorta here. Here is the right coronary artery, coronary artery, and here is the, this is the left coronary artery that we see here. Here is the LAD, or the anterior interventricular branch. You can see there's a few more branches here, and then here is the circumflex branch, and you can see how it feeds down over here and then goes around behind and feeds the posterior aspect in behind. Okay? The right coronary artery, and there's way more than that, but that's for our purposes, I'm just leaving it at those couple to understand. The right coronary artery, it divides into the right marginal artery, which serves the lateral right side of the heart, and the posterior interventricular artery, which runs to the heart apex within the posterior interventricular sulcus. Everybody follow me so far? The left branched into the anterior interventricular artery, which travels down the anterior interventricular sulcus. And the right branches into the posterior interventricular artery, which travels along the posterior interventricular sulcus. Both of them head to the apex. One on the anterior surface of the heart, and one on the posterior surface of the heart. Where they do meet. Together, so at the apex of the anterior interventricular artery and the posterior interventricular artery, they merge together to form something called an anastomosis. So if I were to do and look up at the apex of the heart, we'll just say we're looking at it here, this would be posterior and this would be anterior. Both arteries would come around to the apex, so this would be the anterior interventricular artery, and this would be the posterior interventricular artery. Then they start to do this. Okay, so that's from the anterior, and the posterior does this. That coming together of all those arteries and that network is called an anastomosis. And it's great that we have one. If I happened to have a clot and had a heart attack that cut off the inferior part of the anterior interventricular artery, Can we still supply the apex of the heart? Can we still supply the apex of the heart? Via the posterior interventricular artery and the associated anastomosis. Okay, so this is something the body does in many different areas. In fact, the research shows athletes, people who train and work out fairly consistently for a lot of their life, we actually build anastomoses just through the fact that the requirement is high because the heart's being used in exercise. So all these networks get made. And they find that individuals who were, shall we say, athletic in their day and trained a lot, they might have a heart attack, but it ends up being very small because they've created all these anastomoses, better known as collateral circulation. So they have created a network so significant, if they were young and had a blockage of an artery, they might die because that artery doesn't really anastomose and a fairly large surface area or area of the heart dies. Whereas with lots of anastomoses, there's a lot more collateral circulation that's feeding that myocardium and it's less likely to die. Okay? So again, as the capillary, so at the apex, we have this anastomosis that occurs between the anterior and posterior interventriculars. Between the right coronary artery and its branches and the left coronary artery and its branches, they supply nearly or pretty much all the right atrium and all the right ventricle on the right. And, of course, on the left, we have all the left ventricle and most of the left parts of the heart from the left coronary artery. Right? So the vessels send, now, so what happens? So we have all this blood in the chambers. It doesn't feed the myocardium. It is this circulation that does. So we now know that it travels through these sulci and that the myocardium is supplied by these superficial vessels that run along the heart. So how do they work? If we look at, shall we say, just the myocardium here, okay, actually, I'm going to do this. Sorry. Maybe I'll do two different colors because it'll get a bit confusing. We're going to make the myocardium green. Okay. Well, that's not a very good marker, is it? Let's try this one. That's better. Okay, so this is the myocardium. These vessels run along the top, wherever they may be. And as we know, they run along these sulci and along the superficial part of the heart. They then send branches inward to supply the myocardium. I'll just put a few in here. So you get these branches that travel into the myocardium. Now we must remember, we also have veins, right? They're here as well, and they do the same thing. So, the vessels send branches inward and supply the myocardium. They deliver their blood only when the myocardium is relaxed. So, when the myocardium is in systole, contracting, it's squeezed so hard, blood can't get into it. It's not until the muscle is in diastole or relaxed, then blood then can enter into the myocardium to feed it. So they deliver their blood only when the myocardium is relaxed. What's interesting is the heart requires 1/20th of the blood supply to meet its metabolic needs. 1/20th of 5 liters the heart needs to be okay. Now, the other thing you don't know yet because we haven't done physiology, but heart muscle relies entirely on aerobic metabolism. There's no anaerobic metabolism in heart muscle. So any blockage of oxygen, heart muscle is in trouble. Well, no, because Boyle's law, container, right? Smaller a container, the higher the pressure. The larger the container, the lesser the pressure. It's not a container, but when the myocardium is contracting, the pressure is so high, it's higher than the 120. or the 80. When it relaxes, that pressure gets down below that 120-80, blood goes in. Okay? And it's able to, and then when it contracts again, it pushes deoxygenated blood out and through the venous system, right? So at the capillary beds of the myocardium, the oxygenated blood enters the cardiac venous system. So we have this contraction and relaxation, blood in, blood out, and that's how the myocardium gets fed. And as I said, it is entirely aerobic in nature. So anything that blocks, good Lord, lifting. Oops. Pushed the wrong button. It answered it. Anything that blocks the system, like the arterial system, everything distal to that artery is cut off. And if we don't get at it in time and open up blood supply to it, it will infarct, which means it will die. And when it dies, it is replaced by stromal cells, not parenchymal cells. So therefore, it's scar tissue and never comes back again. And that part of the heart will never contract and contribute to the ejection of blood. And this is why it is so important with chest pains that the individual get to the hospital. It's called the golden hour within 60 minutes, and has an intervention that resupplies the myocardium with oxygen so that you don't get death of heart muscle. This is why it's so important, okay? So you can see here we've got the meal. Oh, for God's sakes. You can see how here's our right coronary, our coronary artery and our left, and you can see all these branches. Now, I'm going to show you something here. This is a friend of mine. And last summer he was golfing and he got really short of breath. He could barely walk on the course anymore and he really started to get compromised. He was short of breath. He was having chest pains at night, which is really scary because he's not exercising. So we had an angiogram, which means that they went up through his femoral artery and they injected a dye into his heart to see how the dye would flow through the heart. Those dark areas are plugs. There's your aorta. There's your right coronary artery, so your left coronary artery and your right. And you can see there's your right coronary artery, right? There's your left. Look at that. Circumflex blocked. You can see LAD here, blocked here, blocked here. You see all those? Look at this, right? We've got a 95% blockage of the mid lesion in the right coronary artery. We have a 98% osteolesion in the ramus, 90, 90, 95. These are arteries in the heart that are almost completely blocked, and he lives and he's still alive. They have to go in and they have to do angioplasty and stents and bypass. We had to have bypasses and stents to repair it to get enough blood there. Now, he was a triathlete, marathon runner, so he had built a significant amount of collateral circulation because he should have been dead. You see a heart like that, this individual should die. His dad died at 42, so he has a genetic predisposition to hyperlipidemia. Right, so that's why, any of you, if you have a first degree relative, mother, father, brother, sister, who has an MI before the age of 50, you should have your bum in to see your physician and be tested after the age of about 30. Until he had the shortness of breath and the problems while he was playing golf that summer. Yeah. Only just his problems when he was playing golf. Yeah, just like he would for angina pectoris. Weeks only. Yeah, only weeks. Because you. Until you have to be above a 50% blockage in order to be symptomatic. So this is why any one of you, including me, could have blockages of your coronary arteries, but because they're less than 50%, you're asymptomatic, but you probably have coronary artery disease. And just like they've done studies and they found fatty streaks in 1-year-olds in the coronary arteries. Yes, ma'am. And someone like me, because of the era I grew up in, Swanson TV dinners, fried bologna, all those sorts of things. Like I ate what my parents thought at the time was a very healthy diet, but really wasn't. No, usually you're clear until you get outside, mom. I guess you could possibly if you have a predisposition to it. Well, yeah, what happens is you get damage where you get proliferation of lipids underneath the two layers between the muscular layer and the endothelial layer of the blood vessels, and then it builds up, you get an inflammatory response, and then you get plaquing, like a harder kind of plaque, and then there's an epithelial lining put over top of that, and it gets larger and larger, and eventually it breaks. And once it breaks, like I talked about earlier, you get turbulence in the blood doesn't like it, and it clots, and then if the hole's small enough, you get the blockage, and then you get the heart attack. Does that kind of answer your kind of, sort of? I'm sorry, did you say he passed away? So the circumflex is called the widow maker. So the more proximal you get blockage, because remember distally gets blocked off, so the more proximal you get a blockage, if it's high up in a coronary artery, you're pretty much doomed. Because that means everything distal to that blood supply is affected. Whereas if you get blockages down here in smaller areas down towards the apex, then you're only distal to that's kind of being affected. But the thing is to understand, the vast majority, close to 90% of individuals, their first symptom of heart disease is a heart attack. They have no symptomology whatsoever until they're just doing whatever, and oh my goodness, and then away they go. And quite a number of those, their first awareness of a heart attack is when they're dying. Like they've had a massive heart attack and they die. And they had no symptomology whatsoever, like none. And it could have been running, been an outdoor person, mowing lawns, cutting trees, and whatever, and had absolutely no symptomology at all because of this 50% rule. They could still have 50% blockage and have no issue whatsoever. But there is a predisposition. Where was his lipid profile poor? Interesting. Did they? Well, there are genetic disorders where the vessels themselves are not good, where they break down quickly, or they. This is going to seem like a really bad question. What, he didn't do cocaine in his earlier years, did he? Cocaine is brutal on the heart. Cocaine addicts. That's why Matthew Perry died. That's why he had the heart attack in the hot tub because he did so much cocaine. Cocaine is bad, bad, bad for your heart. It just starts to break down those coronary arteries, and it's just there's so much damage. It's not good. But yeah, I would wonder. So you obviously you want to be tested exhaustively. Okay. Yep. Well, now they know. Now though, they can intervene, and outcomes are so much better, right? But yeah, that's a buddy of mine. So veins. So of course we had arteries that went out. We have veins that come back. So the cardiac veins roughly follow the same path as the arteries. The veins join together to form the coronary sinus, which we looked at is on the posterior aspect of the heart, which then empties into the right atrium. As I said, whenever you hear the term coronary sinus, it's an extremely thin-walled vessel. It almost looks like a floppy sack. Because again, there's very little pressure in it, and it doesn't require it. And your largest one is in your head. It lies between the hemispheres of the brain itself. The three large veins feed into the sinus. The great cardiac vein, which is returning blood from the anterior interventricular sulcus. the middle cardiac vein, which is bringing blood back via the posterior interventricular sulcus, and the small cardiac vein, which runs along the inferior aspect of the heart. And there's many more, but those are the only three you need to know. Okay? There are several anterior cardiac veins which enter directly into the atrium anteriorly. So you can see here that, you know, there's quite a few here that feed the heart. But at the end of the day, if you really truly think about it, it's not that vast a network to feed a really important organ, right? It's just got this little tiny circulatory system unto itself that helps feed it. Okay. Part two. All right, so we talked about the one-way movement of blood in the heart. Remember, into the right atrium, right ventricle, pulmonary arteries, left atrium, left ventricle, aorta. So, yes. No. It's a collection sac that's bringing back all the deoxygenated blood from coronary circulation. That then empties into the right atria. Yeah, there's a big one in your brain where after the blood's all been used by the brain, it collects in the sinus, and then through the jugulars, the sinus gets drained via the jugulars that head to the heart. So we have this one-way system, right, following that pathway of blood. How do we ensure the blood moves in the direction that it does between the chambers? Remember, right side has its own way and left its own. This is done via one-way valves. So the internal movement of blood through the chamber is a one-way system. And to ensure the direction of movement, we have four valves that ensure this. They open and close in reaction to changes in pressure. Of course, as a chamber contracts, what's going to happen to the pressure of the blood that's in it? It's going to go up. Right, it's going to get more pressure. So you have a valve that's going to react to that increase in pressure, and one valve will open and another valve will close. If we have a chamber that has a closed valve and an open valve, where will the fluid run? To the path of least resistance, which is the open valve. And that's as simple as how the heart works with its valves. So you can see we've got valves here that are facing downwards between atria and ventricle. And then we have valves that are facing out into the vessels that has blood leaving the ventricle to go out into the vessel, whether that's the pulmonary artery or the aorta. So you see you've got valves either going out into pulmonary circulation or out into systemic circulation. And then you have two valves that relate between the atria and the ventricles themselves. So let's do the atrioventricular valves first. Atrioventricular tells you exactly where they are. They're between the atria and the ventricles, right? Atrioventricular. So they then are located at the atrioventricular junction, and there are two. And of course, their responsibility is to prevent backflow of blood out of the ventricles back into the atria. We don't want blood to go back into the atria, so that's what these valves prevent. The right one is called the tricuspid valve. So between the right atria and the right ventricle is a valve called the tricuspid valve, and it is made of epithelium and connective tissue, and it's called tricuspid is because it has three cusps. Between the left ventricle and the left atria, we find the bicuspid valve, and it is made of two flaps. It is also known as the mitral valve. So the bicuspid valve and the mitral valve represent the same valve. And the way to remember it, because if we look at the way blood flows, you have to try it before you buy it. And that, through the movement of blood, it tells you which one's on which side, right? Bicuspid valve, right? Tricuspid valve's on the right. And bicuspid valves on the left. Got to try it before you buy it. So we can see here, remember, we've got those papillary muscles and these tendons, you can see that the tricuspid and bicuspid, they face down into the ventricles, so that when pressure in the ventricles goes up and blood wants to travel upwards, these will snap closed and prevent blood from traveling back up into the atria once the blood is in the ventricle. You can see it here from the top. Here's the mitral valve or bicuspid valve here, 1, 2 flaps. And here's the tricuspid valve here on the right, 3 valves, 1, 2, and 3. And we're looking down from the atria into the ventricles. So we can see here that here are our atrioventricular valves here and here. This is when they're open, so there's low pressure in the ventricles. Blood is going to enter into the atria and drop through these holes, so the blood in the atria will drop into the ventricles. And then when the ventricles contract and the pressure of the blood goes up and the blood is trying to come back into the atria because of the increased pressure, these valves balloon closed and prevent blood from heading back up into the atria, and will, of course, path of least resistance will be into either the pulmonary, you know, depending right or left, either the pulmonary arteries or the aorta itself. Yes. It's called regurgitation or stenosis. And we talk a lot about that in path one. So again, this is another form of a murmur where you would hear a swooshy sound because blood is gurgling back up into the atria. So it does affect certain aspect of the efficiency of the heart in terms of blood getting around, but it's not uncommon. Everybody here has heard of strep throat, yes? Okay. What's important about strep throat? Is to take your antibiotics. So streptococcal bacteria loves heart valves. Chews them all up. Mitral valve prolapses can be a result of streptococcal infection. This is why, you know, when you go to the doctor, they want to check you for strep, and if you have strep, they put you on an antibiotic. Because before antibiotics, children would get strep throat, and these valves would get damaged significantly. They get, like, organic material on them. They get all rough and bubbly, and then they don't work properly, and then the children, of course, would become adults and be significantly compromised in terms of heart function. So that's why strep throat, you got to deal with strep throat. Don't play around with it. You got to get rid of it. That's why, you know, they do, though, I don't know if anybody's been to the walk-in or whatever, they can now do a swab. They swab the throat, and they can test immediately. And if you have strep throat, you're getting the antibiotic. Don't even fart around with it. Yes? I have no idea why. I get that. I totally agree with that, but not with strep. Interesting, Mika, if that were the case, then children in the past before the advent of antibiotics would have all lived. We have no idea how common childhood deaths were before the creation of antibiotics. If you scraped yourself on a nail and you bled, you're likely going to die with some kind of infection. Because simple infections didn't stay simple back before antibiotics. They got really, really bad. That's interesting. I'm going to look that up because my fear is it's the same as in Canada. You know, money does drive the boat a little bit as well. And, you know, this whole idea of removing PSA tests for prostate and mammograms, not necessarily as much anymore because of these false positives and everything. I'm not so sure if they're always, because I always get my PSA when I have my physical, man. I want to know. Prostate cancer is a little too silent for my liking, so I'd rather spend the money and have the PSA done and find out. If I get a false positive, if I have to have a biopsy done and it's a bit uncomfortable, it's worth that or dying. So, okay, so that was the atrioventricular valves. Now, the other valves we have are the valves that relate between the ventricles and the vessels that they're ejecting blood into, and these are known as the atrioventricular valves. Now, of course, attached to these valves are cords of connective tissue, and these are the tendons that attach from the papillary muscles. I called them tendons before, right? And they put them up to the edge of the flaps. Those tendons that run from the papillary muscles to the valve are called the chordae tendinae. And they are a tendinous material that run from the tip of the papillary muscle to the margins of the valves. Right? So they attach these cusps to the papillary muscles. And when the heart is relaxed, of course, the cusps hang down into the ventricles. And as the heart contracts, the pressure of the blood in the ventricles increases, thus raising the flaps until they meet, closing off the atria. If we didn't have the chordae tendinae and the papillary muscles, they would continue moving upwards. They would invert inside out, like an umbrella with too much wind, and blood would move in the wrong direction, right? When the muscle of the heart contracts, so do the papillary muscles, which, of course, then increases the tension of the chordae on the edges of the flaps. So we can see here are our chordae, here are our papillary muscles here, and we can see the chordae tendinae that are attaching all along the margins of these flaps, of these valves, be that the atrioventricular valves atrioventricular valves. Like those flaps, the bicuspid, tricuspid, right? That's where you'll find them. We can see here in a pretty fresh heart, you can see all the chordae tendinae in here, and you can see how they're also attaching here on the margins of the flaps themselves. A human? Yeah, it's probably that's probably a little bit of hypertrophy due to long-standing hypertension. Yeah, it might be a little out of context with the diagram too, though. But you can get hypertrophied hearts from cardiomyopathies, long-standing hypertension, those sorts of things. When I took my cardiac course many years ago, we had a coroner used to come in with his bucket of hearts from all the dissection, all the autopsies he had to do, and he in his big bucket he'd pull all these hearts out. I've actually seen heart cancer, tumors on a heart, that sort of stuff, and they're relatively rare. But he pulled this heart out that was the size of a cow heart, right? And he pulled it out of a 90-year-old lady. 90. It's because she had such long-standing hypertension, the heart literally blew up like a balloon because of that existing pressure. This is the problem with existing long-standing hypertension. It's back pressing on the heart, and it will start to enlarge immensely. That it's just called a hypertrophied heart. Same as hypertrophying your muscles when you work out, right? Okay. Let's leave it at that. We'll do the semilunar valves next week. So we've got heart to finish, heart physiology. Then we're into blood and blood vessels. And then we go into respiratory. And we're almost done. Yeah. Correct. 8 to 10. Yes. Next week's test is from weeks 8, 9, and 10. Yep. And the usual, you know, 40, 45 questions, right? On the Akindi, so no different than usual.